Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is the Scummy Mummies podcast. Hello, I'm Minnie Gibson.
And I'm Helen Thorne.
Welcome to the Scummy Mummies podcast. Now, who have we got with us today? It's Sophie Ennis-Bextor!
Hooray!
Oh!
It's that one!
I'm very impressed you managed to muster even that level of enthusiasm.
Ooh, for my introducing myself, yeah.
Bearing in mind that you had a baby 7 weeks ago,
yeah,
Sophie.
Yeah, and he's here, so if you hear any hiccups or snuffling or snorting or maybe crying, it's Mickey.
Oh, well, it's usually okay. Helen, so that's
yeah.
Fine.
I'm very emotional. I'm sure I'm perimenopausal.
Yeah.
Hi, Sophie. Hi, Mickey. Welcome to the podcast.
And thanks for having us in your house.
I was just about to say, in your beautiful home. We won't give out the address, but it's it's very nice. That's all I'm going to say. In London area. So that's it. But we're thrilled you're on the podcast now. Should you introduce yourself? Would you like to introduce yourself? Who are you, Sophie Ennis-Bextor?
Oh, you're asking a sleep-deprived person
all right.
to introduce themselves.
Would you like us to describe
please,
you?
Please, yes.
Okay, so Sophie's sung some songs. She's written songs. She's a mother of five. And pretty much a legend, I would say, Ellie.
Is that what you would have said, Sophie?
She's a bloody legend. Yes, and we probably know, Sophie, you've been around for quite a while on our, like, TVs, our radios. When did we first see you? On Blue Peter, is that right?
Well, yeah, if you were paying attention, yeah, I had two brief outings on Blue Peter when my mum was presenting the show, so in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Your mum is Janet Ellis,
yes,
is that right?
Exactly, yeah. Yes, exactly, yes. But yeah, my first bit of music was when I was a teenager, so I was in a band called The Audience, who was signed to Mercury. They were kind of like an indie band, really.
Oh, I'm familiar. So last night I was talking to my friend Keith, and I said, oh, we're going to see Sophie Ennis-Bextor tomorrow, and he was like, oh, I should have given you my Audience CDs to autograph.
Whoa.
And
well
I was
done,
like,
Keith.
Oh, I didn't know you're a big fan. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm a big fan. And then he started going on, and he was like, oh, and she did this amazing cover version of a song from Greece.
There were worse things I could do.
And he talked about that for about 5 minutes. And I was like, Keith, I'm not being funny. You're getting weird. I'm not telling you where she lives.
I'm impressed with Keith, actually.
No, he said to say hello. He's a big fan.
Oh, say hello back.
Yeah, I'll give him your number. But yeah, you started off in the audience. And
yes.
Then you, when did you go solo?
Sort of by default, really. The band actually split up by the time I was 20. And then I did a song called Groove Jet with a DJ called Spiller in 2000. And that was kind of forced me into a solo career, really, in that I wasn't in a band anymore.
Mm.
So I would never really saw myself as being a solo artist. It's what happened after that. Really.
And that song was huge, wasn't it? Did you think when you, like, did you record it and think, say to each other,
nailed
this
it.
Is a hit, this is
definitely
absolutely
not.
Mega.
Definitely not. My radar for that is rubbish, like really, really bad. So I knew that I liked it, and I knew that... I think from my point of view, I'd finished with this band, and I said it was an indie band, and I just needed something that was a breath of fresh air, really. So for me, doing a dance record was just something to sort of challenge me and do something completely different. And so I didn't know anything about the dance world at all, and I had no idea it was going to do that well. It's still pretty astonishing to me, really. It's going to be 19 this year, and I'm still singing it. And if it's a sunny day, sometimes someone plays it on the radio, and it's like it's lovely. But no.
How many times do you think you've sung it in your whole life?
Oh, I'd actually really like to know. I'd be very curious to know. I could probably work it out. If I worked out gigs, number of gigs, and then I sort of added in a few sound checks per year and then multiplied by 19. It's got to be up there, getting sort of thousands, I reckon.
Yeah. Be honest, do you ever feel like you're like, oh, I really don't want to go out there? And because we do songs in our comedy show. Mm-hmm. We're the same as you, that's what I'm saying. We're exactly the same. as hugely successful international pop stars. But there's like I'm thinking of a song. You know which one I am. And
kill me now.
Love it. But like sometimes we're like, like when we sound check, we can't even sing in the sound check now. We're just
sound checks are the worst ones though for that actually, I think, because there's no one even responding to you. At least like Murder on the Dance Floor, I love doing in front of a crowd. Every time I'm very happy. But doing a sound check, I'm like, oh, this is really annoying. Because I know how it goes.
Yeah.
I don't need to sing. And there's no one giving me any feedback. So it's just a song I've sung billions of times without, like, much sort of, like, to feed off, really. But I have got a song that I did on my second album called Won't Change. It was a single. And during my tour, I did a bit where people could request songs. And if someone requested that, I would force myself just to speak the lyrics rather than sing it, because the lyrics are so bad. It was like a sort of punishment.
Is it one particular line that you just...
I'm very happy to whip myself with it. So it goes, I used to change my hair like I changed my mind. I tried to change a tyre, but I'm not that way inclined. That's not even the worst line.
Look out, Shakespeare.
It's wonderful. I used to change my accent, my diet too. I'll still change my underwear if that's okay with you.
Wow.
That's spectacular, right? That is spectacular.
You should rap that.
I'm really awful.
Were you high?
I think I was just distracted. It's around the time I just got a game with Richard. And I think I just wasn't really that bothered about the kind of music I was making.
Yeah.
I just wanted to be with my new boyfriend and, didn't want to be making music at that time, probably.
Does it rhyme? That'll do.
Because there's stuff that we do. There's stuff...
Are you alright? You burping?
I don't know. No, I don't. I'm just going weird.
It's Sophie Ellis Bexter's house.
No.
For God's sake.
I mean, it's all natural. It's God's work, Ellie. There are jokes and songs that we write going, oh, I guess this will do. And then they'll absolutely land with the audience. And you just never know, do you?
And then there are jokes that we think are absolutely hilarious.
Amazing. Like,
nobody.
No, nothing.
Well, in return to you saying you do songs, I basically sometimes during my gigs end up doing what is like very bad stand-up comedy, because I get this sort of I think it's like my dad's gene where I suddenly feel compelled to make jokes, but they're really bad jokes, and quite often my band are looking at me like, can we start the next one now, just to stop this. But I've done ones where in my head this is going to be amazing, and then it's just awkward, it's horrible, and I'm not even a comedian, so it's not even like I've got something else to back it up or another bit of material. That was kind of it.
But you ride that way being on stage. You're high as well. You're like, oh, I've got something else for you.
I know. Suddenly just your voice echoing around the room, and then just silence. It's painful. The worst one I did of that was when I still makes me cringe. I did a tour with Take That. I was supporting Take That, so we were doing 34 dates with them, and night two, I think, I came out on stage, and bearing in mind that supporting Take That means coming out into an arena full of, let's say, 8,000 women basically waiting for 4 men, and they get you for half an hour. So I had to come out and go, hey, and the microphone had been set at a really low level. And so I went up to
Mark, bless him.
Well, thank you. You see, you obviously have a very similar mind to me, because I got to the microphone, adjusted it, and went, I was going to say, and they went, no, I will tell you, to like this arena. I was like, I was going to say maybe it had been set for Mark. And they all booed me.
No! And then I ruined your punchline.
I'm actually really glad you said it, because it means that it's not just me.
No.
I thought it was funny enough to say on the internet, which is even more people than an arena.
If you quantum leaped at that point, it was horrible. I mean, you're literally getting booed.
Oh, no.
And I was like, my stepdad's quite short.
Some of my best friends are short.
Exactly. It was awful. It was probably awful.
Yeah. Oh no. And then you had to go and sing.
I thought maybe I would get fired from that. That was like date two, and I thought, we're not going to see the other 32. They're just going to say, thank you so much, we found someone else to support us.
Did Marco in hear about it?
I don't know, but he's such a nice guy. He's probably way too polite to ever have said to me if he did.
It's okay, Sophie, it's worth
it. He's never coming on this podcast.
If you're listening, I'm not laughing at that.
No.
She looks angry.
Stony face.
So what's it like being like a famous mum? Have you found that challenging?
I think, I don't know about famous mum, but I think being a singer that's mum is probably easier than people who have like 9-to-5 jobs, because at least I can sort of shape what I'm doing a little bit around the kids and take them with me. So Mickey here's already been to work with me for a few days, and you know, you can't do that if you have a proper job. So
no.
I think it's easier in that regard.
Can you sing and feed a baby at the same time?
I have done. In fact, I recorded a song once. My sixth album, Familia, I recorded that when Jesse, my fourth, was about 12, 13 weeks. And so he was in the studio with me the whole time. And yeah, I had to do some recordings where he was literally feeding in the booth. I don't know if that
in the booth on the boob.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just not going to get done.
No, so. And it's the best way to keep them quiet. I've found exactly. Just shove a boob in their face and they everyone's happy.
Yeah, exactly. Works for grown-ups as well.
Oh yes. I'm not allowed to mention my husband on the podcast anymore, but let's just leave it at that.
I say it's mine. My husband loves a tit in his face. There we are. Perhaps that'll balance it out a bit.
Just say it another 25 times and we'll get halfway there. Now, yeah. You mentioned your fourth child. Have we actually mentioned... We have mentioned you're a mother of five. And you've five boys, in fact.
I know. That's quite funny, isn't it?
You make cock.
I'm getting quite good. Well, I feel like maybe it was like a sort of biblical challenge, you know, like you have to just get one right. And until you've got one right, I will give you another and another and another. So, yeah, I feel like it's like I just have to raise one of them to adulthood successfully.
Yes.
And I've made it, yes.
Yes, the world needs really good men. And you're obviously raising them... with strict feminist principles and all that she is.
Yeah, of course. I mean,
obviously, she might not be. She might be a massive misogynist. I mean, you know, you never know.
There's a wild guess about the old misogyny.
Nice people, yeah. in fact, if anything, they're probably a bit too used to me being kind of quite. I think, especially when you have your first baby, you realise how much is put upon them because of the gender that they are. And so I've sort of gone completely the other way with wanting to feel like every option is an option. But I think they probably get a bit bored of me kind of chatting that way sometimes. It's like, oh, she's...
Yes, we hate the patriarchy, mum.
Exactly,
yes,
yeah. Chat about that.
My husband once said to me, he said, oh, look, can you just stop going on about the patriarchy? Can you just have a day off? And I went, do you think the patriarchy is having a day off? No, you go to that meeting of the patriarchy and you tell them I will not stop as long as you keep having these meetings. And then I realised maybe I had gone a bit far. So how old is your... Is 15?
Yeah, nearly 15, yeah.
So what have you learned over 15 years of raising boys? Or do you think it's no different to girls, really? I mean, it's difficult.
I mean, I don't have much... Well, actually, no, I do have things to compare it to. I'm the eldest in my family and I've got three little sisters. And I felt very overwhelmingly when I had Sonny, my eldest... that I had a baby who just happened to... You know, so I had that person who just happened to be a baby when I met him. And I think that there's so much about who they all are that's just them and nothing to do with whether they're a boy or a girl. So I don't think it is that different, but then, I don't know, people sometimes tell me it's different. But to my standpoint, where people say, oh, you're outnumbered, I'm like, well, I'd always be the only mum, even if I had all daughters. I don't see a massive difference, but I don't know. Maybe I'd have girls and be like, wow, this is... so amazingly different. Would I? I don't know. Do you both have daughters?
I have two boys.
Yeah, I've got a daughter and a son. And yeah, I mean, they're all going to be different. Like, you know, I had a very sort of serious, studious girl first, and then Hugo came along and basically tried to break the doors off all the things and rip all the puzzles and rip all the flappy books and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a girl could have done that, or, you know, I don't think it... They're just going to be themselves. But yeah, obviously, like, I've just spent the weekend at a ballet concert doing my daughter's hair and makeup, and then Hugo has spent the weekend reading about war. So I mean so, but maybe they, yeah, who knows why, you know, they've chosen those sort of things. But yeah, I kind of... I'm very aware with Matilda turning 10, you know, she's very interested in periods and her body changing and all that sort of stuff. So there's going to be those kind of differences, obviously.
Yes, I've heard, yeah, that obviously is like, I think the transition into young adult is a lot more obvious and cringy when you're a girl, isn't it? Because you've got these really awkward markers, whereas for a boy it can happen at different times and it's a bit more subtle and, you know, feel less vulnerable, I guess. But I still have to tell them all about those things as well. I want them to understand what would be happening if they were a girl. And I'm like their sole representation of living with a woman. So I have to... I'm not kind of one of those people that will hide things away. I want them to be really relaxed about it all, actually. Mm. I want to raise men that if they do choose to, you know, go out with girls and live with women, I want them to be really comfortable with what that means. So, yeah, that's all my job, isn't it?
I mean, how's it split between you and your partner? Does he do the sort of the sexy chat?
The cock?
No, I think I've done a lot of that myself, which is really pretty embarrassing. I think I did a lot of it too early as well. Not age inappropriate early, but I just think I introduced things that maybe weren't quite where they were at. I remember with Sonny, 'cause it's always the firstborn, isn't it, that you make so many silly mistakes with. But he was about 3, I think, and he started asking where babies come from. So I bought this book, a picture book called something like Where Willy Went, about a sperm that races to get to the egg. And it's, you know, sort of all little cartoony drawings for kids. And there's a bit where there's the sperm and they're all hanging out. And they've got like a cafe, they can go to a cinema and all this kind of thing before they do the big swim race. And I thought it kind of gone quite well. And then we were in the park and Sonny said really loudly to me something like, "Well, there'll be a fairground in my bum for all the sperm when I'm big." That's not really what I intended it. And then he said, "Do you think there's a baby in your tummy?" I was like, "No, I don't think so." "You don't know, it might be some of daddy's sperm in there." It's all like in the park. I was like, I don't think. That was quite a conversation I thought we could be having after the book. But then again, maybe it's exactly what I deserved.
It's very, no, very relaxed. We all have to be very comfortable with this. Yes. I'm much better now. I used to go very high pitch whenever they asked me about sex and, you know, testicles and things like that. But now I go, thank you for asking me that question. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. No. Now ask your father.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah.
Yes, it was for about 10 minutes and Daddy and I were both in our 30s. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Well, actually, when I said to Kit, who was 9 at the time, that we were having this baby, when I said, "Kit, we're having a baby," he said, "So what, did you have SEX last night then?" The very sort of knowing look of it.
Wink.
Like, yeah, exactly. And I was like, actually, Kit, it was about 12 weeks ago. And he went, "What? Why didn't you tell me?" Because I think if I told you that kind of thing, your child would be marked with trauma. You don't want to grow up in a house, right? Hey, kids, yes. Your dad and I got lucky last night.
Yeah, we'll just mark it on the calendar with a love heart.
I mean, I think it was your dad. It was 12 weeks. I can't really remember. Who knows, really? We'll never really know. Now, you mentioned Kit there. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of... Should we do the serious bit?
Yes, okay, come on.
Serious chat.
Go Radio 4, Ellie.
Now, Kit, am I right in thinking, was of your 5, he was the one that was born premature?
Actually, the first two.
Oh, yeah. First two.
Oh, yeah. Right. So suddenly the 6-foot chap that you met when you came in.
Strapping ginger lad.
Yeah, he was born 8 weeks early and then Kit was born 9 weeks early. And Sonny was born quite sort of healthy size. He was sort of 3 pounds 8, which... Is it you that said premature baby?
Yeah, my son Joe was 9 weeks early and he was 4 pounds, which again they said
God,
to me
quite
is quite a good size for that. Yeah.
So you'd know that. But then when I had Kit at 31 weeks... He was 2 pounds 6. He was really tiny. And again, you wouldn't pick him out in a lineup as being a premature baby now that he's 10. But it was quite scary.
Yeah. So what was your story with Sonny to start with, I guess? Did you know you were at risk of premature birth?
No, not at all. No, I was 24 when I was pregnant with Sonny and I thought I was sort of getting on with it. But I wasn't really thriving. I didn't really enjoy being pregnant like I thought I would. And I was finding it quite tricky and just feeling a bit antisocial and a bit, towards the end, a bit headachy and just not really enjoying being pregnant and not blooming. And everybody kept telling me, "Oh, no, you look great." And I just sort of knew I didn't. Mm. And then, about 30, 31 weeks, I got diagnosed with preeclampsia, which kind of explained the not feeling great and being really puffy and the headaches and all this kind of thing. And then the way to make me better was to deliver him early. So the same week that I was diagnosed, like later that week is when they delivered him. So it was a bit of a shock.
Mm.
And Richard and I, we'd only been going out 6 weeks when we found that we were having a baby. And then...
That's very quick to plan a pregnancy, isn't it?
Yes, I know. I love when people say, "Was it planned?" Like, you must think I'm very intense girlfriend. but he'd only moved in like 2 weeks before Sonny was born. Yeah. And
you're not like the Craig David of pregnancy.
No,
he's looking for a drink on Monday, got knocked up on Friday.
Exactly. Well, that was me, but it wasn't intentionally. So it was definitely a shock to the system. And then when I, because I had preeclampsia, relatively young, they said, "Oh, the chances of you getting it again are very slim." So when it happened again with Kit, I was really surprised. And also, I felt much better in that pregnancy. I thought I was doing quite well there. Mm. But then I've now had 3 full-term babies, so I can do it.
Mm. So with the birth itself, because with Mike, so Joe, I didn't have preeclampsia. I what they think maybe happened is I had the norovirus.
Oh, wow.
You and I, we did a podcast on the Friday.
Yeah.
And then I woke up very sick Saturday morning, and then probably stupidly, we went and did that gig.
Blimey.
Well, I mean, in retrospect, I probably wouldn't do it again. But, you know, it's one of those things, isn't it? It's mad. I'd had a baby before and that pregnancy was fine. And, you know, we didn't have any money then. We were just starting out and, it was a thing and I really wanted to do it. And I felt all right. I didn't feel... I certainly didn't have any labour pains and I just stupidly... Now I wouldn't do it, knowing what I know now, obviously. But I just sort of stupidly thought, oh, it will just be all right. And obviously it wasn't.
Also, you might have just thought the worst outcome would be you're just not very well for a bit longer rather than actually giving birth.
Exactly. And that night I felt fine. I think I had a curry, I went to bed, it was not a thing. So, and I don't know that it was the doing the gig that pushed him out. They think it was more that it was the virus itself that he was like.
So you went into labour the next day?
So next day I went into labour and I rang my friend Jessie, who's a nurse and a health visitor, and she told me later she could hear in my voice that I got into labour, but she didn't want to tell me that. So she just went, just go to hospital. And I was like, well, should I
call? What does she mean you could hear in your voice you'd gone into labour?
She's known me all my life, and she just said she's done a lot of births and stuff, and she could just hear by the sound of how
baby whisperer.
Yeah, that's so extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah. So she was like, no, call the midwife on the way.
Yeah.
But Pete take you to hospital? I was like, yeah. So she's like, go to the hospital now. So it all happened in a few hours.
Mm.
And the problem was, well, there were many problems with that as an experience. But I don't know if you had this. One of the things for me was I didn't know a lot about prematurity. And so the birth itself was not that traumatic. I sort of thought, oh, well, I'm in a hospital and I've got, you know, it's King's, one of the best premature baby hospitals in the world. And they're going to take him out. And I heard him cry when they took him out. Mm-hmm. And they had to wean him away, but they told me that. So that was all right. And I was off my tits on morphine.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, I've had a baby. And that's all right. And they'll look after him. And then in a week or two, they'll just send us home. And I'll just feed him and it'll be fine.
Mm.
And as you know, that's not how that works.
No, and you don't really have time to process it at the time because you're already sick by the time you're being told all this is going to happen. So... And there's actually, in most of the pregnancy books, the chapter on what happens if it doesn't go to the, you know, each week developing as it should. It's pretty slim normally, actually, and it's normally a bit of a kind of, if you have one of these, this will happen and that'll be that. So I felt like I didn't really know very much about how it worked having a premature baby either. And I had a little bit more experience than you. My sister was born 10 weeks early when I was 11. So I had vague snapshot memories of going to visit her in hospital. I knew she would stay in, my babies would probably stay in for a little while. But I also knew that Martha is now a very, you know, she's now like in her 20s. But at that time, she was already in her late teens. And I was like, she's a successful young adult now. And so the end of this road will be okay. But there's still a lot of stuff I wish that I'd been told a bit more properly at the time, actually. And some of it as well about how it affects babies and children growing forward as well. And like some of the ways it can change their processing issues and things like that. Not in a way that should mark them out, not labelling, but more just in terms of just preparing for that. So you think if they're struggling to tie their shoelaces, do a maths problem, get their reading and writing up to speed, it will all come. It might just need a slightly different way of learning. And I didn't link those two at all. It's sort of taken me doing it sort of when they're a lot older, really.
Has that been the case with both your sons then? They're just learning things in different ways?
Yeah,
different
definitely. Yeah, I mean, they're both bright kids, says their mother. But no, they are bright kids. But Sonny had problems with maths, something called dyscalculia. It's like dyslexia, but with numbers, which is most likely something to do with how the brain develops when they're born early. And with Kit, it's more sort of traditional like dyslexia thing, which is luckily a lot more support for that, actually. And look, I don't know, maybe that's just them, but I think there is, most people have told me there's probably a link, so I just think it would have taken the pressure out of me trying to push him through over hurdles he wasn't ready to cross, really.
And how long, so with Sonny, how long was he in the hospital for? How long did you,
he was
relatively big, wasn't he? So
there's like a few markers they're waiting for. One of them is weight, their weight being a certain level. And then it's like, I think feeding them, being able to feed them by themselves, regulate their oxygen and regulate their temperature. I think those are the four markers. Once they've hit all those targets, they can go home. So he was nearly 5 weeks, and Kit actually was only nearly six. And when Kit was discharged, he weighed 3 pounds 10.
Oh,
I was sent home with a baby outside. It was really scary. And I was quite intimidated by it, actually, because I didn't really feel like I wanted to be responsible for something that vulnerable, really. He looked so tiny, and people sort of look in the buggy to see him be a bit, you know, taken aback at how small this baby is. So I found all that a bit unnerving.
Yeah, and especially with Kit, you had Sonny, who was
he was five by then. Yeah,
yeah. So did you have extra sort of support at that time?
I think actually it was probably that thing of thinking, I've already got one, I can do this, it's fine, I've been through this before. I think we were, Rich and I, were a bit matter of fact in a way, and I think it was only really when Kit was a bit older that we could admit to each other that we were actually really quite scared. But at the time, I think we just got on with it.
Yeah.
And I think as well, we felt like we'd sort of got away with it with Sonny, and maybe we weren't going to be as lucky with Kit. And he was a lot more sick when he was first born. So I think there was lots of stuff like that we just kind of felt we had to just, yeah, get on with it. But really, it was actually quite tough, if I'm honest.
Yeah, you do go into that weird... not survival, but protective kind of mode, and that all those weird hormones that are pumping through you, yeah. And also you just haven't basically slept for such a long time. You're slightly mad.
Definitely.
Yeah. I can't look back, and when they used to say sleep in the baby sleeps, I was like, oh no, fine. I'll just do a couple of loads of washing and make some mints. I'll be fine. I'll just make some more mints.
And I don't know if you found this, but I also found that like you're saying, like getting through that, it just feels like survival, right? When they're in the hospital, it's just like day to day, and all that kind of you're focused on is them getting out alive, basically. Yes. Because they told me, again, like the first few days, I didn't really get it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, well, okay, he's going to have to stay in hospital longer, but then he'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Because, like, we're in hospital.
Yeah.
And then on, like, day 3 or 4, I realised that nobody... I just wanted someone to say, oh, he's going to be all right. He's going to be all right. And nobody had said that. So I ended up saying to a nurse, is he going to be all right? And she just said, well, it could go either way. Oh. And that was the moment at which I really finally got it. Oh my God, my baby might die.
Yeah.
Even surrounded by all these wonderful bits of equipment and people and all of this. And then, so then that became the focus. And then when we got out of hospital 6 weeks later, I then had a sort of, that was supposed to be the happy ending. That was supposed to be the end of the film.
Yeah.
Like, we've made it and we've survived. Yeah. And now it's all going to be fine. But then of course you're knackered and you've got this baby. And I found that quite... Did you find that difficult?
Yeah, as well, because also you've had that safety net of all those people, doctors and nurses, that you can always ask, and, you know, and there's a form to it, because even though you're the parent and, you know, you've got your instincts, you know, you still say, is it okay if I get them out of the incubator? Is it okay if I do this? And you have to keep washing your hands and all those things that you wouldn't be
doing. It's like when you hear people come out of prison and they think they have to ask to go to the toilet.
Exactly.
Like, institutionalised.
Yeah, you are, you really are. So when you come home, there's this real feeling of, like, okay, there's no safety net now, and... all those things that were monitoring all these vitals on this baby is now my job. And also there's a weird limbo of you've had your baby and people don't know whether to congratulate you or not. Mm. So when you bring them home, there isn't that like, ta-da, we've just had a baby. So you sort of missed a bit of grammar, you know, it's like punctuation that's just gone.
For us, it was our second baby as well. Yeah. So we were like, is it just that they don't give a shit because it's the second baby and that's the way it goes? Or is it a weird... Yeah, it's odd.
It's because you're fucking British. I can say that as an Australian.
What do you mean?
Because people get uncomfortable with uncomfortable things. Right. They don't know how to cope with, it's been a bit scary, and I can see you're a bit sad. I don't know. Do I hug you? Because they don't want to offend you, so they say nothing or do nothing. And that's the worst.
Yeah.
That's you're right. And I think that was especially true after, you know, because once we were out of hospital, everyone wants you to just and expects you to be just totally great. Everyone's like, oh, well, there we are. Everything's great now. Everything's great. And actually, I wasn't. I was like, I feel like I've just been through a car crash.
Mm-hmm.
And although I'm not in the actual car anymore, like, I feel like I'm still recovering from that. And I haven't been able to do the work of recovering for that because I've been focused on this baby and this hospital thing.
Yeah. Mm. And I think, you know, you don't want people to label your baby, so you're very quick to be like, no, take that away. That was what happened then, and now we're at home and their life can begin. But at the same time, you kind of want to go, but they have been through this thing, and there is actually another layer to this. But you kind of, I don't know about you, I kept switching from one to the other, like, wanting the nurture and then actually wanting to be treated the same as every other new mum. It's definitely not ideal. And also when they're in the hospital, although they're a baby, they're treated really like a patient. So you're not supposed to, you know, you don't look at the other babies in incubators. They don't, like a lot of the other parents, if you see them there, the people don't really talk, don't really make eye contact. So it can feel quite isolating in that way as well.
Mm.
I thought I'd really quite like to just have a place where we can just chat about what we've been through and what we're sharing, but... Yeah, and some of the babies are really sick in there. It's not a nice environment. I think that's why I got so obsessed with the feeding and getting the milk going and all that kind of stuff, because it was the one job I could do that the hospital couldn't do. And I was like, right, I'm going to just do all that the whole time. I'll just, you know, bring in my little milk bags and all that. God almighty, it took over my mind.
I was the same. It was like
they had to build another wing for all your milk.
It was like in Stalinist Russia when they had the grain drives. It was like, I was like, I'm going to pump the shit out of these tits, because that is the one thing I can do. That is a practical thing. I produced so many, because they give you the little bottles to put the milk in. I produced so many bottles of milk, they had to give me my own drawer in the hospital freezer.
Just showing off now.
And I mean, you know.
Look, every time I went to visit her, she was just double pumped. I was like, I don't need to see any more. I must.
Yeah. All my friends saw that.
And then I filled that drawer and they had to give me another drawer.
Well, that's
and I was
good,
like,
that probably
yes.
went for donor milk as well, because sometimes other mums aren't, you know, finding it as easy. So that's good for the other babies as well.
Do you know what? I offered it when I left hospital, I offered it for donation, and they said to me, do you know what, we'd have to screen it and all this.
Oh, really?
And they said, and this nurse said to me, she said, look, take it home, put it in a bottle, and then you can have a glass of wine while your husband just gives you a break. And actually, and at the time I was like, no, but I want to do this altruistic thing. But actually, that was one of the best pieces of advice I ever had. Because there were nights where I was like, do you know what, yeah, I want to drink a bottle of Merlot and go to bed at 8:30 because this is hard.
Yeah.
And I was very grateful to that nurse for having suggested that.
There, dear.
So how are you now? Do you still think about the birth and the hospital bit, or are you...
You've
done three more since then, so probably not.
I do actually, though, because also we've had all our children in the same hospital, so whenever you walk in those doors, that the smell of the hospital brings back so many memories. And I think also there's something about having babies that makes chronology a little bit loopy. So suddenly you feel like you're bumping into yourself each time you've had, you know, each time you're a new mum, or I don't think, you know, time doesn't go in the same logical step anymore because your brain's a bit loopy, like all the hormones. So suddenly, you know, you're very aware of that feeling you had, you know, 6 years ago with a different baby. So I think
having a baby makes you Doctor Who, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're sort of time traveling back to all that experience before. Yeah. So
your vagina's like a TARDIS, much bigger on the inside.
So lovely.
I mean, I can't speak for yours. I've not seen it. Sorry. I'm speaking for myself. So
that's right.
Spectra, I wouldn't dream.
Billy Piper lives up there, actually. Billy, love your work.
Yeah. One of the original Blue Peter dogs. Sorry.
No. God, she was saying something really
she
deep.
She said something very profound.
No, I wasn't. About visiting her past self.
I wasn't.
Yeah, we were talking
about... You made reference to her in a massive
hall. I was talking in a really convoluted way, but my brain is, like, totally befuddled.
And yet, did you want to go back to the same hospital? Did you make that kind of choice to...
Definitely,
because... Some people would want to run away and go, I just want a new start.
No, I loved it, because I had all my babies at Chelsea and Westminster, and they've got an amazing neonatal unit there, and also I had the same consultants for them as well, so I wanted to go back because I felt very safe, and they do extra tests and keep an eye on me, because obviously I've just had it with Mickey, where I got, you know, the same week's gestation as when I had the others early, so hopefully I won't be going back through the neonatal doors again, and I'm staying in the other side of the hospital. And it's so nice having a baby that can stay with you from when they're born. What a difference that is. I'm quite glad I had it that way around with the premature babies first, because when I had my third, I was like, now I get what it was I wasn't, you know, I was missing out. Yeah. So it must have been hard for you with your second, because you know what the other story looks like, and I didn't really.
It was really hard, because I was in hospital with Joe for the first sort of 5 or 6 days. So I really missed my older son, Charlie, who was at home.
Yeah.
So I couldn't wait to get home to him. But then I went home, and then I woke up the next morning, and I had that thing where you don't know where you are. And then the last time I'd slept in that bed, I was pregnant.
So your baby was still in hospital at this point.
Yeah, so I'm not pregnant, and my baby's still in hospital. I had this desperate, immediate urge to get to the hospital immediately.
Yeah.
But then I had this three-year-old going, Mummy, you're home.
Yeah.
And that sort of, it subsided. I learned to manage it, but that was really difficult.
Yeah,
really
I can imagine. Well, I felt like that the second time with Sunny being at home. And also with when we had Sunny, we used to go and visit twice a day and spend like ages. But when we had our second, I was at home for most of it and then just pop in maybe like probably mostly once rather than twice. And I felt really bad. That I couldn't spend more time with my new baby, but I felt like I needed to be where Sonny was because he was nearly 5 and very aware of the fact I wasn't there. So then you get that guilt that accompanies so much of parenthood anyway.
Yes.
I mean, that's
I'm not
it.
Where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah, and now I would say I'm absolutely fine about it, about the whole thing, 364 days of the year. And then on Joe's birthday, I've had to come to accept that I get really upset. First of all, I drink too much. That probably doesn't help.
I mean, that's always a good idea.
Yeah, it's always
when you're feeling a bit
emotional or anxiety. definitely drink more. No, but, you know, because we always have a little party and, you know, there's fizz and it's lovely. And then I still get very upset and I have these weird flashbacks. Again, not so much to the birth, but to the the 6 weeks in hospital and all of that. Like, do you still, is that going to go away, Sophie Ellis-Bextor?
I guess you'd have to work out what it is you're upset about. Is it because you don't feel like you really had a chance to process at the time how scared you were about it all?
I wonder. That's what I don't know. And someone said to me, well, maybe you should have some counselling about it. And I'm like, well, but I'm all right 364 days out. I don't know if I can be bothered to, you know.
No.
Just ask a really famous woman.
That's what I said. I said, I'm not going to go to the therapist. No, I'm going to go around to Sophie Ellis-Bextor's house.
Yes, exactly.
The songstress behind Murder on the Dance Floor.
Yeah. And say, she'll sort me right out.
Will I be all right? As if she's some sort of clairvoyant.
Yeah, I don't know. I think also it's okay to feel sad about something that was scary. I don't think you necessarily need to fix that, do you? I mean, if sometimes it's healthy to acknowledge the things that have been hard, and also you do it from the safe place of knowing that actually it ended up all right and your A's birthday. So maybe you're just acknowledging that you were worried that wouldn't be a thing you were going to be celebrating, which is scary. It's horrible. Yeah, so I think it's sometimes it's okay to feel sad about things if they're a way of keeping you feel sane the other 364 days of feeling right is pretty good, isn't it?
Well, there we have it, listeners. Sophie Ellis-Bextor says, I do not have to go to therapy. That's the correct answer. Thank you very much.
You've learnt one thing today.
Yes.
Take that with you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, I should explain, the other reason, apart from me just wanting to unburden myself to you, that we're talking about all this, is because you've been doing some work with a charity called the Born Organisation.
Yes.
How did you get involved with them?
It's quite recent that I'm directly involved with them, but I've been aware of them for a little while, and I've actually been sort of knocking at their door saying, is there anywhere I can help? Because the chap who set it up is called Mark Johnson, and he was actually my consultant who delivered Mickey here.
Oh, right.
And, and Kit, my most premature baby.
And he's a professor, also, isn't he? So he's an actual man who knows about...
He's a professor now, yes.
Ellie loves a very highly...
I do like a professor.
Yes,
he's
exactly.
Very highly qualified. He's got a very reassuring voice. And when things are going a bit wobbly in pregnancy, he's exactly the sort of person you want in your camp saying, listen to me, it's going to be all right. So he's been doing lots of research and set up this charity all to do with premature birth and trying to prevent premature birth, because apparently there actually isn't as much research going into it as that he feels there should be anyway. But also I think it's like the number one cause of...
I'm going to blind you with stats,
please,
Sophie Ellis-Bextor. I've got them here. So yes, because I think, you know, you might be listening to this and thinking, oh, we'll just listen to these women just banging on about this problem because it's, you know, our experience. But actually, yes, premature birth is the leading cause of death in kids under five in the world. 85% of women who have a preterm baby don't even know that they're at risk, which was certainly, you know, I'm in the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Also, if we could prolong pregnancies by 1 week, it would save the NHS £260 million a year.
Wow. Extraordinary, that one, isn't it?
I mean, that's... So it's worth
it. Better than
it,
Brexit, really.
Isn't it?
So, yeah.
But yeah, so I think this is the thing that it seems to me they're saying, that there's just not... It's overlooked and it's underfunded, basically.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that there's lots of causes. So it could be something like preeclampsia, like I had, but with you, it was just you still don't really know. You just went into labour. It could be this, could be that. My mum as well, when she had my sister 10 weeks early, her waters just broke at 30 weeks. Don't really know why.
Again, it could have been the fact I went out to work, but again, as they said to me in the hospital, there are lots of women around the world who go and work in the fields all day and don't have a premature baby, and they're doing 14 hours a day in difficult conditions hoeing soil. So
are they wearing a cat suit though? You were wearing a cat suit.
I mean
maybe it's a cat suit,
you know. There are
thank you, Colombo.
There are some islands in the South Pacific, we don't know what goes on. Still,
my friend had her baby 6 weeks early in Australia because she went down a bumpy road. She went on a very, very bumpy road, and then the baby decided to exit.
Wow. But again, you see, how many women have been down a bumpy road pregnant, not had a baby?
I know, both literally and metaphorically. Oh, fuck
that. I like
that
the idea of metaphorically.
Metaphorically.
I was really happy.
I love metaphorically.
But then also, when I was pregnant with Mickey, I did loads of gigs jumping up and down, literally in platform heels, and he stayed in. So I don't think, you know.
Yeah, there's
no. You know, there's obviously certain little nuances that make some people more predisposed to certain things. But yeah, I think what he's doing, all the research, is really valuable.
Because they are trialling the first new treatment to prevent preterm labour for 50 years. Right. There's a stat for you, Helen Thorne.
You have researched this well, my friend.
I've actually copied some things off the email they sent us. I know, it's unbelievable, isn't it? I've done so much research.
Thank you, born.org.uk.
.uk.co.
Yes, .biz at Born Charity. Born with an E on the end.
Yeah.
There we go.
So, because they're quite a small charity. They're only set up like 6 years ago, I think.
Exactly,
so,
yeah. Because this is something that everybody that works with charity is doing just in their spare time, and at the moment it's so tiny, they just use like a somebody's office. It's not kind of like somewhere where it's got massive overheads or anything like that. It really is all about putting it all back into the work. But yeah, Dr. Johnson, he really is like I said, he's one of those people when things are perilous when you're pregnant, he's one of those people you sort of cling to like a rock, and everything he says you're like, if you think it's going to be all right. So he's definitely the right man for the job.
I had Dr. Batt at King's College Hospital, who had a similar sort of calming, like, he's obviously done this a lot.
Yes,
it's all going to be all right.
Yes, it's so important, isn't it?
Yes,
because when I was having Mickey, I had this sort of comedy meeting at the hospital where Dr. Johnson wasn't there, so somebody else stood in for the consultant appointment, and she was really scary. I mean, she was the opposite. She said to me, so you're going to have your fifth cesarean, because I've never had labour. I've had all of my babies have to be planned C-section, which isn't ideal, but it just stops me from being in any danger, or as much danger. And she said, so, you know, with the grafts, fifth C-sections, all everything goes right up on the graft. So risk of hemorrhage, blood loss, damage to organs. I was like, right, okay. And then she went, and have you considered in the operation, have you considered being sterilised?
Oh,
yeah, that is quite... I mean, I found it really funny at the time. I was like, wow, that's quite a question. No, I haven't.
Should we just whip out your uterus while we're there?
Yeah, yes. I was like, okay, that's food for thought. But then when I spoke to him, I said, oh, should I be worried about fifth C-section? And he said, no, it should be fine. He's one of the people with his voice. No, it should be absolutely fine. I feel like it would be fine for you to have this operation. Can't see any problems. Thank you, Dr.
I just want his voice on a loop on my phone. Everything's going to be fine, Helen. You're going to be fine.
Yes.
Good.
Yes. That would be nice. Oh, and it is all fine. Look at this guy. Oh.
He's just chilling.
We've sent him to sleep, look.
Oh, hello.
Well, not for the first time an audience member has passed out while listening to the sound of our voices.
I think he's enjoying it. He likes having the hubble bubble of conversation.
There we are. That's the serious bit done. Thank God for that.
Can we ask her about a new album, Ellie?
Oh, go on then.
Yeah, talk about something.
Go on. So,
don't
so.
Mind these babies. Let's talk about me.
I bloody well want to talk about you. I haven't had a premature baby. I'm not in your fucking club. Anyway, tell us about your new album. What's that all about?
Yeah, so I recorded the album last year, and it's called The Song Diaries, and it's orchestral versions of my singles. And it's coming out in March. I've got a tour as well with an orchestra and with the band, so we can do live disco, which is really fun.
So are you pleased with how the album's turned out? Is it amazing hearing your voice with proper violins and that?
I mean, that's what we need to do next to our
orchestra. I've really loved it. I mean, it's nice to have a bit of a challenge as well, because singing with an orchestra is very different to singing with a band. And singing songs that I've sung billions of times before, but sort of in a different way. So revisiting things like Groove Jet or Murder and thinking, right, how do I want this to sound this time? And what new thing can be brought out of it? It's been a bit of a challenge, and I've enjoyed it. And I can't wait to do it all live. That's, for me, the real, like, icing on the cake, because it's just so decadent having a full orchestra. It's like, it's kind of extraordinary, but lovely.
Oh, I think you're right. We're missing a trick, Helen. Really,
I know. I want to, like, I've always wanted, like, a full jazz band behind us. Yes. You know, like Amy Winehouse had.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, with our amusing parodies of Bonnie Tyler songs.
Only you can just drown out our singing, basically. Yeah. oh, what a joy. And so what's next? So you've got this year. Have you got other sort of plans for new stuff, or maybe just getting some sleep?
That'll happen at some point. I heard a report on the radio, actually, that said that it takes 6 years for a new parent to get back the sleep, apparently.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that terrifying? I mean, basically, it's never going to happen to me.
It's the thing, you have five, that's like 30. Yeah, I just
feel like my husband and I just literally feel like, that's never going to be us, is it? We're just going to be permanently knackered. So this year I've got June to November to... and then festivals in the summer.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it should be cool, actually. And then, I will get started on another album, but I'm not in a massive hurry.
Can I just ask one thing? Because I know you toured with Take That, but did you also tour with George Michael?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Can you tell us about that? Because, you know, we obviously love him dearly.
Yeah, well, he was an incredible performer. I did watch the gigs we did 8 dates with him, I think, so I watched quite a few of the shows, and his voice just sounded amazing. The only sad thing is I never actually met him.
No way.
Which is quite frustrating. Whenever you're the support, you kind of walk onto someone's tour and you know within about the first 2 hours if it's what kind of a tour it is, like the atmosphere. Mm. They Take That were incredibly friendly and shared lots with us. And with George Michael, everybody was really lovely, but he was very private. So to go into his dressing room, they'd sort of built like a sort of shaded walkway so that no one could even see by accident into his room as they walked past. It was kind of covered from the outside. Mm. And I think he was just quite a private guy. He just didn't really socialise that much outside of that.
That sounds ideal. Put that on the rider.
I think so.
Yes,
I think,
that's another thing we need.
We learned so much from George Michael.
Orchestra, and nobody looks us in the eye when we walk into the stage.
Right.
I don't think that's unreasonable, to be honest. Perfectly fine.
Oh,
well, there we go. Now, we always end the podcast with Scummy Mummy Confessions. Mm-hmm. So a sort of story of parenting failure.
Mm. So many. Yeah, I mean, I think I might tell you what has happened just literally last night, because it's probably sums up what sort of a muddle I tend to get myself into, because my 3-year-old Jesse last night didn't want to go to sleep. He's normally pretty good at going to bed, but this time we've just... having a bit of a mare, and he had had a dream the night before that he'd been given some giant coloured eggs. He didn't know it was a dream. He was convinced that someone was about to give him giant eggs. He started talking about breakfast yesterday, and nighttime it suddenly had a resurgence. I want my giant coloured eggs. It's like, there aren't any coming, but... So we went on Amazon, and obviously it's Easter coming up, so I was like, let's have a look at maybe some Easter decorations of these little coloured eggs. I was like, let's get those, we can decorate them ourselves, that'd be fun. But he wasn't really happy with that. He's like, no, I want them now, I want a basket to collect the eggs. So I remember, because we're quite a dysfunctional house, that we still had an Easter basket in the top bathroom waiting to go back in the attic, which obviously doesn't need to go back in the attic because Easter's like 4 weeks away. So I just went and grabbed this basket and then found myself telling him that the Easter bunny was going to come in the night to fill it with some Easter goods. And then I found some like little coloured chips and put them in there.
Aww.
But he was not happy with that this morning. I want the coloured eggs. And I was like, well, they're coming. We've ordered them. He said, no, when I open them, there's Power Ranger toys in there. Well, then they're just little coloured eggs that we can decorate. So this is going to run and run. I'm stuck.
I mean, first of all, you've made your own bed. You're not going
to
get a lot of sympathy out of me.
I just wanted him to go to bed, though.
But listen, if you're in the business of, you know, literally making dreams come true, if you could deliver naked Jeff Goldblum to my room this evening, that would be very nice.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes.
I'll
finish the rest of the dream myself.
Then you can turn into a Power Ranger.
Yes. So my confession is, we went away for half term. We went to, I mean, this is not the confession, we went to French Centre Parks, which sounds like we're complete wankers. But it's actually cheaper. This is actual life hack, this. It's because it's not French half term, right?
Right.
So it's half the price of English centre parks. And, you know, people say, it's not like really being in France because it's centre parks. But, you know, all the shops are closed half the day and they've run out of bread by 8 a.m. So really, it's very similar being in France.
Yes.
It's
ooh,
exactly the same. And we were in the big, the subtropical swimming paradise, or as it's called in France, the Aqualagon. So we're in the Aqualagon. And, you know, obviously you're there for hours, and kids need to pee, don't they? Now, do you let the kids pee in the pool?
I pretend I don't know about it.
Yeah, I've done that.
It's out of my hands. But, yeah, I make an effort in front of other people.
Yes.
Maybe 50% of the time.
It depends what stage we're at with it. If it's if they're telling me post-event, then it's just like...
Yeah.
If they say they need a wee, I take them out of the pool and take them to the loo, right? Charlie said, so he says to me, Mum, I need a wee. I said, all right, come on then, let's go to the toilet. He said, well, no, can't I just pee in the pool? Dad said I can just pee in the pool. Should I just pee in the pool? Like, incredibly loudly. Mm-hmm. And because lots of other English people had worked out that it's cheaper to go to French centre parts of the play, it was full of English people. It was like a last hurrah.
They were looking at
Brexit.
You to see what you do next.
Yeah,
and
you
and
disgusting.
So,
it's all warm. We did that at the Princess Diana Memorial, floaty thing in Hyde Park. And Matilda did a shit and it floated down the ramp.
Oh, it's what she would have wanted.
Oh, well, obviously. People like a candle in the wind, like a shit on a lake.
Yeah. People thought it was probably an homage that time she went on the log flume with the boys in Thorpe Park. Do you know that photo? They just thought it was Matilda's way of paying homage to that.
That's right. She waved goodbye and off it went. Yeah, lovely times. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, what a way to end the show.
Really. Very highbrow and sophisticated, isn't it? So your new album, Sophie, what's it called?
The Song Diaries.
And it's out?
March the 15th.
Where can people find your tour dates and all of that?
Just type into Google. Sophie Ellis.
You do
tour.
The work.
Don't even bother with Baxter because it's hard to spell. Sophie Ellis tour. And you'll find me. The London date's not until November, but it's at the Palladium, so it should be really fun. Good reaction.
Yes.
Very good reaction.
I love the Palladium. Oh, yes. Very strong branch of Five Guys next door. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I know it, actually. Yes.
Yes.
Come and see me and go to Five Guys. Oh, there you go. Night out. Sorted.
Yeah. And if you want to give some money, like I'm going to the Bourne Charity, it's bourne.org.uk and they're at Bourne Charity on the social.
We are such good people.
We are great humanitarians. We are amazing. Great humanitarians.
That's it.
We do so much work for charity. It's unbelievable.
I know. Yeah. We live to give. Yeah. Sophie Ellis-Bexter, you've been a fucking delight.
Ah, thank you.
You are a legend, Sophie Ellis-Bexter. You are a legend.
We will live in your house really soon.
I don't care what they say.
Hello, are you waking up?
Oh, the baby's awake. Quick.
All right, quick.
Get out of the house,
Thank
Ellie.
You so much for coming on the podcast.
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. Until next time.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, there we go. So, do you know, I'm going to give them some money.
Go on.
I'm going to give the Bourne charity the money that Sophie Ellis-Bexter says I don't have to spend on a therapist. That's what I'm going to do.
Would you like me to tell you how much I've spent on therapy and then you give that amount?
Oh, my God, yeah. How much is that?
Oh, that's 18 months times £70.
Oh, I'm not a millionaire. Jesus.
How much are you going to give them?
I'm trying to think. Probably, how much is therapy a go?
About 60, 70 quid.
It depends, yeah.
Depends. Could be 150.
It can be, yeah.
Yeah, probably 50 quid and a bottle of wine. No. So yes, if you'd like to give them some money, you can go to Bourne. That's B-O-R. Crikey, that's them now. What do you mean 50 quid? Do you know how expensive this trial is? She's left us to look after her baby. Look, she's very trusting.
I know.
We've only had 2 each. We don't really know what we're doing.
Oh, God. I want to sleep like he sleeps.
No, isn't he sweet?
No, they do say he's sleeping like a baby. You want to sleep like that. Like he's strumming a guitar. He's a natural.
He'd be a bass player like your daddy.
No.
Yes.
Ba-doom, boom, boom.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.